Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, November 9th, 2025. Portions of this program were previously broadcast on shows earlier this year. Nobel Prize season is here. Every October, committees in Sweden and Norway name laureates in a variety of prizes related to science, literature, and economics, as well as peace work. Six prizes in total are awarded. This past week, five of those were. The laureates received their Nobel Prize medals and diplomas in Stockholm, Sweden, in December. Here is a quick guide to the prizes. First, what are they? Six Nobel Prizes are awarded every year, each recognizing an individual's or an organization's groundbreaking contribution in a specific field. Prizes are given for physiology or medicine, physics, chemistry, economic science, literature, and peace work, the last of which often draws the most attention because of the fame of the people and groups nominated. When are the awards announced? One prize is announced each day from October 6th to October 10th, with one more on October 13th, tomorrow, between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Announcements are made mainly from Oslo and Stockholm and are streamed live on the official digital channels of the Nobel Prize Organization. Monday was the Physiology or Medicine Award. The award for physics was announced last Tuesday. The award for chemistry was announced on Wednesday. Tomorrow, the award for economic sciences will be announced. What do the laureates receive? Nobel Prize laureates will receive a diploma, a medal, and a document detailing the Nobel Prize amount, which this year is set to be about 1.17 million in current exchange rates. If more than one scientist wins in any category, the award is divided among the winners. The Nobel Prize for Medicine was awarded for discoveries about the immune system. A Japanese immunologist and two American scientists shared the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for fundamental discoveries about how the immune system keeps itself in check, preventing itself from attacking and destroying the body's cells. The winners were Mary E. Brunko, a senior program manager at the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle, Fred Ramstel, an immunologist and co-founder of Sonoma Biotherapeutics in San Francisco, and Shimon Sakaguchi, an immunologist at Osaka University in Japan. This year's prize is for fundamental research about a basic question intricately connected to human health. How does the immune system fight a vast repertoire of external pathogens and diseases, but not mistakenly attack our own cells? Human health hinges on this delicate balance, and when it goes awry, it can have harmful results, as happens in type 1 diabetes, where the immune system destroys insulin-producing cells, or in rheumatoid arthritis. The laureate's work shed light on a class of immune cells called regulatory T cells, which the Nobel Committee compared to security guards for the immune system. While the work has not directly led to therapies yet, it helps illuminate principles of how the immune system works that could be harnessed to explore new therapies for autoimmune diseases. This Nobel Prize demonstrates how immunology is central to medicine and human health. The ability to harness, modulate, or restrain immune responses holds promise across a vast range of diseases, from autoimmune conditions to cancer, allergies, infectious diseases, and beyond, Ulrich von Andrian, president of the American Association of Immunologists, said in a statement. This summary from the Washington Post, updated on October 6, 2025. On Tuesday, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences awarded the 2025 Nobel Prize in Physics jointly to John Clark, Michelle H. Devoret, and John M. Martinez for the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling and energy quantization in an electric circuit. The much-loved UW collaborator John Clark is a professor emeritus of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, but he collaborates with the Axion Dark Matter Experiment at the University of Washington. ADMX scans for evidence of dark matter from beneath the Seattle campus in a cold, dark box surrounded by a powerful magnetic field. The experiment is managed by the U.S. Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, and it hinges on technology designed by Clark. I was elated upon hearing the news about John, simply elated, said Leslie Rosenberg, a University of Washington professor emeritus of physics and lead scientist at ADMX. The three laureates were recognized for experiments conducted in 1984 and 1985 that captured two quantum mechanical properties at the visible scale. Clark's brainchild, which caught Rosenberg's attention 25 years ago, is a superconducting quantum interference device, or SQID for short, which can make ultra-sensitive measurements. John Clark first got involved with ADMX around 2000, Rosenberg recalled. To this day, he remains a much-loved ADMX collaborator. The relationship began when ADMX organized a workshop at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory to brainstorm solutions to a technical issue the researchers had encountered. The way the experiment searches for dark matter is akin to a radio searching for a station, but instead of music, it is looking for axions, the particles theorized to make up dark matter. Detecting axions requires amplifying very, very quiet microwaves. At the time, the group only had access to noisy electronic amplifiers, which were drowning out the very signal they sought to capture. At the workshop, Clark presented a SQID amplifier as a potential solution. "We considered all kinds of alternative technologies, but none fit the bill," Rosenberg said. "The SQID amplifiers were indeed the breakthrough we needed." Clark joined ADMX and brought the amplifiers with him. Gray Ripka, a UW professor of physics and co-spokesperson for ADMX, was a postdoc at the time. "The SQID amplifiers gave us the sensitivity necessary to do a search," he said. "We've been operating for years and years and have only explored a fraction of the space, but we couldn't have even started without these amplifiers." ADMX is still using an iteration of Clark's original amplifier, improved upon by his students over the years. Still, the big transition was moving to a SQID amplifier, and that is just one example of how this technology can revolutionize an experiment. The laureates moved the field of particle physics from classical measurement to quantum sensing, Ripka said. "It makes stuff that used to just be on the blackboard, quantum mechanics, experimentally accessible and even useful. In my opinion, you wouldn't have modern quantum computers without the work done by this group." And this article appeared in the University of Washington News, posted on October 8, 2025. On Wednesday, October 8th, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to architects of metal organic frameworks. Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar M. Yagi were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of molecular building blocks with spaces large enough that gases and other chemicals can flow through them. "The cavities on the inside are almost like rooms in a hotel, so that guest molecules can enter and also exit again from the same material," Heiner Linke, chair of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry, said during the announcement of the award. "The laureate's discoveries," he added, "paved the way for the creation of materials that can separate toxic chemicals from wastewater or harvest water molecules in a desert." The laureate's work started with experiments by Dr. Robson in the 1980s and gradually developed over a period of about 15 years. "It takes time for science to be recognized, and it takes multiple workers in the field with different approaches," said Dorothy Phillips, president of the American Chemical Society. The scientists are responsible for developing a new kind of molecular structure that combine metals and organic molecules. Dr. Linka likened the structure to the handbag used by the character Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter series. The bag looks small on the outside, but has space on the inside to fit larger stuff. The scientists' experiments laid the foundation for the development of thousands of metal organic structures with many real-world applications, like trapping gas emitted by fruit so it ripens more slowly. It has sparked a whole field, said Kim Jelfs, a computational chemist at Imperial College London. There's an enormous number of people that work in this area now, she said. In chemistry, molecules arrange themselves in unpredictable structures. The scientists were able to combine metals and organic molecules as building blocks so that even if the size of the clusters change, you would still get the same structure but with larger cavities inside, Dr. Jelfs said. That level of control within chemistry has always been a challenge, she said. So that's part of the excitement. A bit more about the winners. Richard Robson is a professor at the University of Melbourne in Australia, where he has taught since 1966. Susumu Kitagawa received his PhD in 1979 from Kyoto University in Japan, where he now teaches. At a news conference by Kyoto University, he said he learned about the prize while finishing some work in his classroom. He said he'd been getting many sales calls on his phone recently, and so he answered the phone in a bad mood, quote unquote. But during the prize announcement, he said he was surprised and delighted at having been selected by the committee. I want to share my joy with the other two, he said of Dr. Robson and Dr. Yagi. Omar M. Yagi received his PhD from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He was born to Palestinian refugees who settled in Jordan and moved to New York for college, first at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy. He switched to the State University of New York at Albany in 1983. In a phone interview posted by the Nobel Committee, Dr. Yagi said, while waiting for an airplane to take off, that he grew up in a very humble home, sharing a room with the cattle his family raised. His parents could barely read or write. In a news conference hosted later by Berkeley, Dr. Yagi credited the American public university system for what he had achieved and added that getting his first grant from the National Science Foundation ultimately led to his Nobel Prize. Science, he reflected during the earlier phone interview, is the greatest equalizing force in the world. Smart people, talented people, skilled people exist everywhere, he added. During the Berkeley News Conference, he also highlighted the value of scholars coming to the U.S. from other countries, saying that the spread of knowledge often comes from people moving across regions. Science allows us to talk to each other, and I don't think you can stop that, he said. I think that's something that will continue to be important, and enlightened societies will encourage it. That story on the Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, posted by the New York Times on October 8, 2025. And from the Associated Press, also posted on October 8th. A knock at the door, a call from a strange number. Here's how the Nobel Prize winners heard they won. For some Nobel Prize winners this year, the news came with a knock at the door before dawn. For others, it was a long-awaited phone call honoring a discovery made decades ago. One of the Medicine Prize winners, meanwhile, was on vacation in Yellowstone National Park without cellular service. It would be hours before he found out. The Nobel Prizes are considered among the world's most prestigious honors for achievements in medicine, physics, chemistry, literature, economics, and peace. The winners join the pantheon of Nobel laureates, from Albert Einstein to Mother Teresa. Sometimes the award is anticipated. Potential winners plan tentative news conferences, or in the Western U.S., wait up all night for the news. While some prizes might feature household names, the natural science categories typically go to people whose names the general public doesn't know. for decades-old research. Five of this year's nine science winners were in the U.S. when the news broke. Some were fast asleep. Two winners in Japan, 7 hours ahead of Stockholm, were awake and working when the call came from a Swedish number. One thought it was a telemarketer. Wednesday's chemistry prize was the first time this year that the Nobel Committee reached all three winners ahead of the formal announcement. Here's how some of the year's winners found out. Mary Bunko is in Seattle, and around 4 a.m. local time Monday, it was the scientist's dog who woke up first. Zelda's barking roused Bunko's husband. "I don't think he really knew what I was there for," Wasson said. And I said, "You know, sir, I think your wife just won the Nobel Prize." "Don't be ridiculous," she told her husband. But it was true. The trio had, in research dating back two decades, uncovered a key pathway the body uses to keep the immune system in check, called peripheral immune tolerance. Experts call the findings critical to understanding autoimmune diseases, such as type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. The following day, AP photographers Mark Terrill and Damien DeVarganese headed to Santa Barbara, California, to find physicist John Martinez before the sun rose. His wife, Jean, answered the door and told them to come back later, that he needed to sleep. "For many years, we would stay up on the night the physics award was announced," she told the photographers. "At some point, we just decided, that's nuts. We'll figure it out if it's happening, but we'll just get our sleep." She added, laughing, "I was trying to think how I can introduce this, like, do you think you should plan a trip to Sweden?" She finally woke her husband up just before 6 a.m. local time, telling him only that the AP wanted an interview. "I kind of knew that the Nobel Prize announcements were this past week, so I kind of put two and two together," he said later. "I opened my computer and looked under the Nobel Prize 2025 and saw my picture along with Michel Devoret and John Clark. So I was kind of in shock." And then there was Fred Ramsdell. Everyone but Fred seemed to know that he had won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. But he was away on a backpacking trip on Monday when it was announced, driving through Yellowstone National Park with his wife and two dogs, Larkin and Megan. He kept his cell phone in airplane mode, as he often does on family trips. As they drove through a small town hours later, his wife started screaming as notifications flooded her phone. She told him he just won the Nobel Prize in Medicine, alongside Bunko and Shimon Sakaguchi. "I said, no, I didn't," Ramsdell told the AP in an interview the following day from his car. And she said, "Yes, you did. I have 200 text messages that say you won the Nobel Prize." Later Monday, Ramsdell drove to a Montana hotel to connect to Wi-Fi and call friends and colleagues. He didn't speak with the Nobel Committee to get their congratulations until midnight. He said he was stunned and awed to receive the recognition, but he has no plans to change his phone habits, which he says are important for work-life balance. And this year's six Nobel Prizes, honoring groundbreaking contributions in physiology or medicine, physics, chemistry, economic science, literature, and peace, will be awarded in Stockholm, Sweden, in December. The next news item is the complete list of Nobel Prize winners for 2024. They have been announced, and they shine a spotlight on some of the world's most prominent thinkers and innovators. The awards, most of which date to 1901, are intended to go to those who, quote, have conferred the greatest benefit to humankind, unquote, founder Alfred Nobel wrote in his will. Past recipients include the likes of Albert Einstein, Marie Curie, and the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. The first category is physiology or medicine. Victor Ambros and Gary Rufkin won this year's Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine for their discovery of microRNA. Not to be confused with messenger RNA, microRNA is a tiny molecule that tells our cells how to behave. This year's laureates figured out that microRNA plays a key role in gene regulation, which ensures that our cells perform their necessary functions. Understanding microRNA's role is crucial for addressing the challenges that arise when it doesn't work properly, including cancer and congenital hearing loss. Physics. John Hopfield and Jeffrey Hinton won this year's Nobel Prize for their foundational work in machine learning. Machine learning, a subfield within artificial intelligence work, refers to the development of computer systems that can learn and adapt without being given explicit instructions. The laureates figured out how to create systems that process data, similar to how the brain processes information. Their work has found applications across fields, including astrophysics, medical diagnostics, and climate modeling. In chemistry, David Baker, Demis Hassabis, and John Jumper won this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their studies of protein structure and design. Proteins are strings of molecules that drive our bodily functions, from the development of antibodies to the repair of tissues. The laureates figured out how to predict the structure of proteins and design entirely new ones. Their work has found applications in virus studies, vaccine development, and the study of nanomaterials. In literature, Han Kang won this year's Nobel Prize in Literature, the first writer from South Korea to do so, for, quote, intense prose, unquote, that, quote, exposes the fragility of human life, unquote. Her surreal novel, The Vegetarian, about a woman who comes to believe she is a vegetable, brought the author international acclaim. Three of her other books have been translated into English, Human Acts, Greek Lessons, and The White Book. And another translation is forthcoming in 2025. Economic Sciences. Darren Acemoglu, Simon Johnson, and James A. Robinson won for their work on prosperity gaps between countries. The trio of economists looked at how different kinds of European colonization led to some nations being rich and others poor. The laureates' research found that inclusive institutions, such as public schooling, the rule of law, or antitrust policies, were often introduced in countries that were poor when they were colonized, and over time those nations became more prosperous. Meanwhile, other countries experienced low economic growth after they became trapped in situations with institutions that extracted resources, such as through slavery. And finally, the Nobel Peace Prize, Nihon Hidankyo, a Japanese organization of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, won this year's Nobel Peace Prize for 2024 for its effort to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. Norwegian Nobel Committee Chair Jørgen Vatne Fridnes said the group, quote, helps us to describe the indescribable, to think the unthinkable, and to somehow grasp the incomprehensible pain and suffering caused by nuclear weapons. The organization's extraordinary efforts have contributed greatly to the establishment of the nuclear taboo, he added. That complete list of the Nobel Prize winners in 2024 appeared in the Washington Post and was written by Lisette Ortega. Also from the Post, a more in-depth article about the Nobel Peace Prize winner. Nihon Hidankyo wins Nobel Peace Prize for work on nuclear weapons abolition. The Japanese group of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki received the Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. By Ellen Francis and Julia Mio Inuma. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded on October 11, 2024, to Nihon Hidankyo, a Japanese organization of atomic bomb survivors, for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. The group received the prize for demonstrating through witness testimony that nuclear weapons must never be used again, said Norwegian Nobel Committee Chair Jürgen Wattner Friedness. A timely reminder amid globally destabilizing wars and growing concern about nuclear proliferation. Nihon Hidankyo, founded 11 years after the end of World War II, represents survivors of the U.S. atomic bombings that obliterated much of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, killing and maiming hundreds of thousands of people. Japan is the only country on which nuclear weapons have been used. The survivors, known as Hibakusha, share their testimonies to highlight the horrific repercussions of nuclear warfare. Nihon Hidankyo has been a leading voice in preserving their stories and advocating for compensation for the survivors and their families. They help us to describe the indescribable, to think the unthinkable, and to somehow grasp the incomprehensible pain and suffering caused by nuclear weapons, the Nobel Committee chair said in his announcement. He said Nihon Hidankyo's extraordinary efforts have contributed greatly to the establishment of the nuclear taboo, leading to a world where no nuclear weapons have been used in war for nearly 80 years. Never did I dream that this would happen, Toshiyuki Mimaki, co-head of the group, said at a news conference on Friday, October 11th, in Hiroshima, after the award was announced. It is a realization towards nuclear abolition and lasting peace. The 81-year-old also issued a plea to the world to, quote, eliminate nuclear weapons while we are still alive. This is the wish of the 114,000 A-bomb survivors, unquote. Mimaki was just 3 years old when he survived the bombing in Hiroshima. He drew attention to the plight of children amid Israel's war in the Gaza Strip, the enclave that UN officials have described as a graveyard for children. The world is in a difficult situation right now. We must continue to make further efforts moving forward, Mimaki said. There were a lot of children who grew up as orphans after the atomic bombing, and right now children in Gaza are suffering. Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba congratulated the organization and said it was extremely significant that the group was being honored for its work over the years. The Nobel Committee has previously honored efforts toward eradicating nuclear weapons, awarding the 2017 prize to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. In 1995, British physicist Joseph Rotblat and the Pugwash Conferences on Science and World Affairs won for their efforts to end the nuclear arms race. With this year's prize, and with nuclear threats looming over the conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East, the Nobel Committee made an appeal to countries around the world that are upgrading their arsenals or preparing to acquire nuclear weapons. At this moment in human history, it is worth reminding ourselves what nuclear weapons are, the most destructive weapon the world has ever seen, Friedness said. When we look at the developments and the conflicts around the world, we see how crucial it is to uphold a nuclear taboo, to uphold the norm, he told reporters, adding that it was alarming to see that norm threatened. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, an arms research group, said this year that nuclear weapons have not played such a prominent role in international politics since the Cold War as the world's nine nuclear-armed states, which include the United States and Russia, continue to modernize their arsenals. Dialogue between Moscow and Washington on nuclear arms control has all but ground to a halt in recent years, while the use of nuclear blackmail has spiraled. Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a nuclear threat against the West and Ukraine last month, indicating that any country's conventional attack on Russia that was supported by a nuclear power would be perceived as a joint attack. The announcement followed a flurry of nuclear-related threats from Moscow in the face of Kyiv, Ukraine's requests to the United States and other allies to lift restrictions on Ukrainian missile strikes inside Russia. Meanwhile, as tensions between Israel and Iran soar, U.S. officials have expressed concern that Israel may seize an opportunity to attack Iran's uranium enrichment facilities after Tehran's attack on Israel this month, The Washington Post has reported. Analysts also say that there are growing fears that Tehran's setbacks could move it closer to considering the use of a nuclear weapon. As established by Alfred Nobel in his will, the Peace Prize recognizes contributions to the fraternity between nations. Winners have included those directly involved in peace negotiations, as well as individuals and groups that have worked to promote human rights, democracy, arms control, and climate action. Arguably the most prominent of the Nobel Awards, the Peace Prize, consisting of a medal, diploma, and 11 million Swedish kronor, about $1 million, will be awarded at a ceremony in Oslo on December 10th, the anniversary of Nobel's death. Last year's honor was awarded to imprisoned Iranian human rights activist Narges Mohammadi, while the 2022 prize went to human rights activists and organizations in Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus. Henrik Urdal, the director of the Peace Research Institute, Oslo, said that as automated weapons and AI-driven warfare emerge, the prize given to Nihon Hidankyo and its call for disarmament is not just historical, it is a critical message for our future. And this report on the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for 2024, Nihon Hidankyo wins Nobel Peace Prize for work on nuclear weapons abolition, was written by Ellen Francis and Julia Mio Inuma, published in the Washington Post on October 11th, 2024. And you are listening to Science Matters on Sun Sounds of Arizona. As the Washington Post summary of the Nobel Prize winners noted, past recipients include the likes of Albert Einstein, Marie Curie, and the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. A new nonfiction book has been published entitled Marie Curie, Mentor to Women or Martyr to Science. In a new biography, Dava Sobel, who edits the column Meter, focuses not just on the legendary physicist and chemist, but on the 45 women who worked in her lab. The article is written by Kate Zernicki, who is a reporter at the New York Times. She is the author of The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins and the Fight for Women in Science. The book, written by Dava Sobel, is entitled The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. In June 1921, in the flush of a triumphant six-week American tour by Marie Curie, a prominent male scientist urged the young women graduating from Bryn Mawr to follow her example and enter into a career of science. An unsigned editorial in the New York Times scoffed, not to take anything from the illustrious Madame Curie, then the only woman to have won a Nobel Prize and the only person to have won twice. But surely, the editorial opined, the young women must have understood that such achievement was not for them. While some might be efficient in the laboratory for drudgery and perhaps original investigation, most had yet to develop the scientific or mechanical mind. Men had more latent capacities in those directions. Women were too emotional to view the facts abstractly. The Times was, to use the old newspaper cliché, not alone. Back home in Paris, the French Academy of Sciences refused to elect her a member. It later repeatedly rebuffed her daughter, who also won a Nobel Prize. In her new biography, The Elements of Marie Curie, Dava Sobel quotes a letter from a Yale professor recounting Curie's American visit, saying he was pleasantly surprised to find she was quite keen about scientific matters. "But I feel sorry for the poor old girl," he added. "She was a distinctly pathetic figure." The belief that women lack the intrinsic aptitude to master math and science stubbornly persists. As Sobel begins her book, even now, nearly a century after her death, Marie Curie remains the only female scientist whom most people can name. Previous chroniclers of women in science, especially Margaret Rossiter in her three-volume book on the Americans among them, have argued that Curie's exceptional achievement made it harder for women who aspired to follow her. They already suspected they'd have to be twice as good to get half as far. She made the standard more unattainable and gave cover to male department heads looking for an excuse not to hire them. She's likable enough, but she's no Marie Curie. Sobel, the author of several scientific biographies, Longitude was a bestseller, and Galileo's Daughter, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, looks for a more positive result. She sets out to show how Curie's discovery of radium lit a path for women in science, namely the 45 aspiring female scientists who spent a formative period in the Curie lab at the Sorbonne. But her telling confirms, heartbreakingly at times, just how narrow and gloomy the path was. Curie herself was able to have a lab of her own because her husband, the physicist Pierre Curie, demanded that the school where he worked give her the space. Her father-in-law moved in with a couple to babysit for their two children. After Pierre Curie and Marie Curie shared the Nobel Prize, the Sorbonne gave Pierre a professorial chair. Marie was relegated to chief of operations in his new lab. The university made her its first female professor only in 1906, after Pierre was killed by a horse-drawn wagon on a rainy night near the Pont Neuf. As with so many early women in science, Curie's is a story of self-sacrifice. Before she met her husband Pierre, she nearly starved herself, living on tea and bread as she studied in a Parisian garret. After his death, she dressed in black and shunned attention. Urged to write a memoir, she wrote his biography instead. She poured what paltry prize money she won back into buying bits of radium for her research. With rare exceptions, the 45 other women subjects appear in Sobel's book only as emanations. Sobel names her chapters for them, but tells little of their stories beyond that. One, Irene Goetz, is mentioned in only one sentence in the chapter named for her. Two get fuller treatment. After Barnard College told Harriet Brooks she had to quit because she was getting married, she did. Her job as a physics instructor, and the engagement, too, only to sacrifice her career for another marriage down the road. Ellen Gleditsch became a university professor in Norway, but after 13 years, the university still refused to grant her tenure or lab space. Support came from several men, one of whom referred to his wife as BG for beautiful genius. When Curie, 4 years widowed, was attacked as immoral for an affair with a married man, Albert Einstein defended her. The man in question went on to have a child out of wedlock with a former student working in his lab. Predictably, no scandal ensued. By contrast, the women in Sobel's book doubted themselves and Curie. Some noted that she barely showed up in the lab as her health declined from years of exposure to the radioactivity she had discovered. And those who did try to improve conditions for women often worried that such efforts only distracted them from their scientific passions. As one suffragist scientist wrote, "I often think very sadly that I might have been more useful to the cause if I had devoted myself to my own special work, as Madame Curie has done." As in her earlier books, Sobel writes elegantly about science, unspooling Curie's pursuits in the lab like a mystery. She leaves us less clear how Curie herself viewed the position of women in science. When a member of the Nobel Committee suggested that she not come to Stockholm to collect her second prize in 1911 because of the bad publicity around her affair, she insisted on going. "I believe there is no connection between my scientific work and the facts of private life." But when Gleditsch and others formed an international society devoted to promoting women in science, Curie declined to ally herself. Her ailments debilitated her so much that she begged off several events on her American tour. Her exposure to the very elements she had discovered ultimately killed her. The Times ran its obituary on the front page of July 5, 1934. Madame Curie is dead. Martyr to science. This review by Kate Zernike, a national reporter at the Times, reviews the book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science, written by Dava Sobel, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This review was posted in the New York Times on October 10, 2024. And now we turn to the double issue of Science News, September 7th and September 21st, 2024. Under News in the Department of Animals, How to Teach a Croc What Not to Eat. After a good scare, the predators stay away from lethal toads, by Bethany Brookshire. All it takes is one miserable night after a bad dinner to make humans avoid an ingredient for life. To teach crocodiles to avoid a lethally poisonous toad, all it takes is one very, very nasty toad butt. Freshwater crocodiles in Australia that chowed down on cane toad carcasses laced with a nausea-inducing chemical were far less likely to eat live toads when the poisonous amphibians came hopping along. This type of teaching could help prevent the predator die-offs that occur as cane toads make their way across the continent, researchers reported on August 14th in Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Cane toads were brought to Australia in the 1930s and quickly began to wreak havoc on native species. Their harm comes not from what they eat, but from what eats them. The toads have large glands that contain potent poison. As cane toads have spread, freshwater crocodiles have fallen for the tempting snack. In the 2000s, for example, croc population densities along the Victoria River crashed by as much as 77% following cane toad invasions. But what if the crocodiles could be taught to avoid eating cane toads entirely? Georgia Ward Fear, a conservation scientist at Macquarie University in Sydney, has been testing a technique called conditioned taste aversion. In previous work, Ward Fear and colleagues released teacher toads, tadpoles, eggs, or very young cane toads that don't yet carry enough poison to be deadly, before adults arrived. Large monitor lizards ate the small toads and got sick, but lived and learned to avoid the lethal adult versions. But baby toads are far beneath the notice of crocodiles. To train crocs, Ward Fear and colleagues worked with the Banuba Rangers, members of an Australian indigenous group who see freshwater crocodiles as an important part of their dreamtime stories, a component of the group's religion and culture. The team collected about 2,400 dead toads and removed the heads, poisonous glands, and internal organs. Researchers laced the remaining toad butts with lithium chloride, a chemical that produces powerful nausea. The team then set up motion capture cameras and dangled the dead toads as well as unlaced chicken bait over the edge of the water across four gorges in the central Kimberley region of Australia. After the crocodile's lessons, quote-unquote, Ward Fear and colleagues headed back to find out if the crocodiles had learned from the baits. They searched for any dead crocodiles and cut them open to see if a toxic toad was the cause of death. Crocodiles learned quickly that once was enough when it came to eating a cane toad. The researchers found remarkably few carcasses of crocs that dined on live cane toads. At one site where toads had already arrived, rangers found 63 dead crocodiles in 2020. But after the team baited the group of crocs that came to the same area in 2021, only three died from eating toads. At another site, no crocodiles tasted toads after their training, and in contrast, a nearby unbaited area saw between 20 and 40% of their crocodiles die from eating newly arrived toads. This is a wonderfully innovative and effective example of the tremendous potential of conditioned taste aversion as a tool for conservation, says Colleen St. Clair, a conservation biologist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. Many scientists have been leery of conditioned taste aversion since early trials in mammals failed in the 1970s, she says. I expect this will be a landmark study, showing that a very old nausea-inducing substance, lithium chloride, is effective for ambush predators like crocodiles. Before the study, rangers and scientists alike would find dying crocodiles thrashing helplessly in the water after eating deadly toads. It's very distressing for us as wildlife biologists and indigenous rangers, Ward Fear says. The result is both an environmental and emotional success. And finally, a New York Times trilobite, posted on October 11, 2024, by Jack Tomisiea. Hairballs shed light on man-eating lion's menu. The Tsavo man-eaters terrorized railroad workers in British East Africa in the 19th century, but their tastes went well beyond human flesh. In British East Africa in 1898, two lions living along the Tsavo River were hungry. This was bad news for the workers building a railroad there. They would retreat to their tents at night, and come morning, some of the men would be missing, the latest victims of big cats that had a hankering for human meat. Bones, flesh, skin, and blood, they devoured all and left not a trace behind them, wrote Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, a British Army officer leading the railroad project. During the nine-month reign of the Tsavo man-eaters, the lions, which like most males of the area lacked manes, devoured around 35 workers. Eventually, construction of the railroad stopped completely until Colonel Patterson shot the two cats. The lions' bodies were initially fashioned into trophy rugs. In 1925, the Field Museum in Chicago purchased the rugs for a display. The two skulls ended up in the museum's collection. It turns out that the Tsavo lions had a taste for more than men. Using hair fragments preserved in the lion's broken teeth, scientists discovered DNA from several species. Their findings were published a few weeks ago in the journal Current Biology, offering a snapshot of the surprisingly diverse buffet of wildlife once consumed by a top predator in what is today Kenya. In the 1990s, Thomas B. Ganaska, a collections manager at the Field Museum, got a chance to examine the Tsavo lion's skulls. He noticed hair fragments in the cat's cracked canine teeth. In 2001, Mr. Gonoski contributed to a paper positing that the lions had developed a preference for human prey because the cat's teeth were damaged and our species' flesh was easier to chew. In the new paper, Mr. Gonoski teamed up with other researchers to further flesh out the Tsavo lions' diets by examining the century-old hair fragments with microscopy and cutting-edge genetic analysis. And an illustration shows us an artist's concept of a pair of Tsavo lions preying on a giraffe. They're pretty fierce, and the giraffe doesn't look like it has much of a chance of surviving. Snippets of DNA found in the lion's teeth matched the hair fragments with several species, including oryx, waterbuck, zebra, and giraffe. According to Ross Barnett, a paleogeneticist who was not involved in the new study, hair is a hearty source of preserved DNA. You can dunk it in bleach to remove surface contaminants, but the DNA inside the keratinous layers will be unaffected, he said. The hair packed inside the Tsavo lion's broken teeth proved to be a dietary time capsule. We were looking at these tooth cavities in the same way geologists look at soil, said Alida de Fomming, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and the lead author of the new study. Analyzing hairs from different layers should give us an idea of the lifetime diets of these lions. The team focused on mitochondrial DNA in the hair fragments, which provide abundant genetic information that is relatively easy to decipher. They compared these snippets of DNA with the genetic record of species native to the Tsavo region and matched the hair fragments with several species, including oryx, waterbuck, zebra, and giraffe. I was pleasantly surprised when we were able to actually identify various species that were authentic for that age, said Reepen S. Molly, a molecular anthropologist who works with Dr. DeFleming at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The team discovered surprises in the hair samples. Modern Tsavo lions prefer Cape buffalo, but the man-eating lions had virtually no buffalo hair in their teeth, an absence consistent with the speed of rinderpest, a cattle disease, through Africa in the 1890s. The team was also surprised to uncover DNA from wildebeest, a species that was not common then in the Tsavo region. This finding may help corroborate historical records suggesting that the lions left the rail encampment for nearly 6 months before resuming their killing spree. There was even genetic material from the lions themselves in the sample. By comparing the two predators' mitochondrial DNA, which is transmitted by maternal lineage, the team confirmed the theory that the two lions were siblings. The sample also contained DNA from multiple human individuals. Dating these hair samples may provide clues to when the lions first preyed on people. However, the researchers avoided further deciphering these remains until they could work more closely with local communities, which may be home to descendants of the lion's victims. Tsavo communities continue to live alongside lions, and the danger that these predators pose is still real. What strikes me about the Tsavo story is that it is almost incomprehensible to a 21st century Western mindset, Dr. Barnett said. The terror that the night must have brought is unimaginable. This New York Times trilobite, Hairballs Shed Light on Man-Eating Lion's Menu, was posted on October 11th, 2024, in the New York Times. And a postscript. In the double issue, September 7, 21, 2024, of Science News, in Reviews and Previews, we've taken a look in a previous program at a new book about AI called AI Snake Oil. But here's a quick rundown on four other books that might be of interest. First, Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party by Edward Dalnick. This book introduces the eccentric characters of the Victorian era, whose early discoveries of dinosaur fossils drastically transformed our understanding of the natural world, published by Scribner. In the Land of Ninkasi by Tate Paulette, an archaeologist takes a trip back to the cradle of civilization to recount the beer-drinking habits of people living in ancient Mesopotamia, published by Oxford University. Love Triangle by Matt Parker. A stand-up comedian and math writer showcases all the ways triangles come into play in our everyday lives, weaving in the stories of history's most daring mathematicians and thinkers along the way. Published by Riverhead Books. And The Secret Life of the Universe by Natalie A. Cabral. An astrobiologist guides readers on a journey through the cosmos to investigate the likeliest places where life could be hiding. Published by Scribner. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And please remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening today, and please join me again next Sunday.